They never used to ask for volunteers. They used to say, you, and you were in the party. And they usually went over in silence at night, and you didn't carry any equipment. You know, all you carried was a rifle and bayonet. That's a few details for that. The parties were arranged like this. Number one was the rifleman. He carried a rifle and bayonet and 50 rounds of ammunition and nothing else. The next man was a bomb thrower, a grenade thrower. He only carried a haversack, which was full of bilges and grenades. And the next man, he also was a bomb thrower. And he helped the first man replace his stock when he exhausted. And the last man was a rifle and bayonet man. And all he carried was a rifle and 50 rounds of ammunition and a bandolier slung over his shoulder, nothing else. The idea was to crawl through the German wire, try and get underneath, and jump into their front line trench, dispose of whoever was holding it by banning it, if possible, without making any noise, or clubbing over the head with the butt. Then you drop into the trench once you establish yourself and wend your way round each bay. First of all, a rifleman would go leading, and then he'd stop at the next bay, which was normally a park which was unoccupied, and the bomb thrower would then throw a grenade towards the next bay of their line, or where he thought it would be, judging from the distance of the other one. Just after it exploded, the man who was leading, the rifleman, he'd dash round into the trench where their bomb they had just gone off and dispose of any occupants that were left behind. And so he'd go on until we cleared the whole trench.
How chilling are those words spoken there to the Imperial War Museum by a veteran of the Great War? It's what we're going to talk about this week. To me, the most frightening aspect, there's plenty to choose from, isn't there, in the Great War, was being asked, in inverted commas, or volunteered, as that veteran described it, to take part in a trench raid at night. This was something that had evolved since the beginning of the war. That area between the lines, which was called no man's land, had to be dominated by each side. Patrols were sent out often to gather information, not just about the enemy's defences, but about the enemy soldiers that were manning those defences. These were not large-scale attacks. These were often, as we're going to see in this podcast that I, Terry Wenham, called Tales from the Battlefields, small-scale attacks involving just as many as a few dozen men or even less. The idea was to kill as many defenders, destroy their fortifications and weapons, as we heard there, gain intelligence and sometimes return with prisoners. But the bit that really got me when we listened to that clip there was the soldier talking about these specialised weapons, knives, knuckle dusters, and improvised clubs with spikes on that had been designed and made by the soldiers for this close confined trench fighting. They'd been introduced when trench raids started to be used in 1914. They wore camouflage unions and blacked their faces up as well. They almost sound like commandos from the Second World War. How terrifying must that have been for the perpetrators of those raids and patrols, and also the defenders, when in the middle of the night these men jumped on top of them, bayoneted them, clubbed them, and if you were lucky, survived to take a man back as prisoner to the other side of no man's land. And that's what we're going to look at this week. Once again, we're going to look at it through the eyes of the soldiers that were involved in these terrifying trench raids. We're going to try as best we can to understand what that must have been like, but I guarantee we won't. How can you unless you were there? And we're going to talk to a man called Neil Russell, who's a serving Royal Marine. And he's researched a couple of raids that went desperately wrong prior to the Battle of the Somme in the spring of 1916, as they tried to gather information about those German defences that they were going to attack. on the 1st of July. We've covered that battle and we will continue to cover the Battle of the Somme in great detail in the podcast. But we often forget, don't we, what happened prior to that Battle of the Somme, the preparation. And we're going to learn more about that now as we go straight into the interview that I recorded with Neil Russell from his home last week. So how did you get into this then, Neil? You're so much younger than so many of us. My wife calls me a battlefield bore. I'm sure she means it affectionately. I've been called anorak, saddo, all these things all through my life. And now I'm 60. I'm quite happy to live up to all of those things. But you're a lot younger. So how did you get into it?
Well, I'm not much older than 30 and I'm happy to live up to all of those things as well. Because like you... It sort of, as you know, consumes your life, doesn't it? But for me, it's probably not similar to you and other lads that we both mutually know. It started very early in my life. My interest has spans almost right back to the beginning of my life. You know, I've got pictures of me. I'm from the Devon and Cornwall area, and with Devon being Devonport, one of the homes of the Royal Navy.
Yeah.
The whole area is surrounded by Palmerston forts from the late Victorian era. And I've got photos of me in these Palmerston forts, knee height, with a short magazine Leigh Enfield rifle that's, you know, twice the height of me, pretending I'm firing it through loopholes and that sort of thing. So, yeah, it goes right back to the beginning for me. And then, of course, as you mature and as you get older, your interest develops from books about the wars that were aimed at children that I read as a kiddie, magazines, through the movies, and then of course again as you get older, you know, your interest matures and you find yourself doing some much more serious study, starting as a teenager with the popular books, so you know, things like Ambrose and this sort of thing.
What about a family connection? I mean, you must have a family connection then, surely?
Yes, I do have family connections, but I wouldn't say they sort of imbue me with the interest as much as just submerging myself in the literature and the movies and all that.
You haven't got a grave. Like for me, you know, I went to my uncle's grave and that was that moment for me. You haven't had that experience then. It's come sort of over time then for you, isn't it?
Yes, I haven't got a grave in my family, but I did know my nanny's brothers and they were all service personnel in the Second World War. Same too on my father's side, although I didn't know them. I've been regaled with the tales. So I always used to hear a story of, on one of the raids, Lovett bringing back a grandfather clock on board the ship that one of my grandfathers was a sailor on, a gunner on.
Yeah.
Stories like that. One of my nan's brothers, Tom, he was nabbed on a lank, ended up flying in the Far East as well. And I met him, spent a lot of time with him actually as a child. And so, you know, he would enjoy telling me about the war.
Yeah, I believe you're a military man yourself.
I am, yeah.
Tell us about that then, if you can.
So it's not very interesting. Certainly not as interesting as things will come today. I'm in the Royal Marines. That's it, really.
That's the elite. Royal Marines are, you know, you play that down, but it's you're an elite soldier if you're in the Royal. You don't just get in the Royal Marines, do you?
No, you don't just get in the Royal Marines. I certainly didn't just get in the Royal Marines, but sort of 15 years later, I think it's perhaps become, I probably stayed in longer than I imagined because it was convenient and now it's become a habit.
You're not going to leave then, are you?
I don't think so. I started when I was 16. Like I've only ever had two jobs. I've been a paperboy and a Royal Marine. So I'm pretty blind to what goes on in the wider in the workforce.
But for me and so many of our listeners, it's the other way around. You know, I always say this, I've sat in an office for 40 years in my business career, pushing bits of paper around for the first 20 years, and the second 20 years sending pointless emails to people. And that was my business life. So that's why now I'm retired, the last stage of my life. You know, it's taken me down this military history route. Whereas a lot of my friends that I've met in the last 10 years through the Army Benevolent Fund, like yourself, are military people. So it's taken me into a completely different world, to corporate world. And it's fascinating for me to meet people like you. So we were looking at what we were going to talk about in terms of, you know, this is Tales from the Battlefield. So we like to look at individual stories. And
yeah, that's right. As you said, I wrote an article for Paul. I think I've entitled the article and Now the Boche Have Got His Body.
Yes.
Which is, I stole from Ewart Allen McIntosh's In Memoriam poem. about his trench raid up north of Gomercourt in May of 1916. And
so you were David's father, and he was your only son. And the new cut peats are rotting, and the work is left undone because of an old man weeping. Just an old man in pain for David, his son David, that will not come again. Oh, the letters he wrote you, and I can see them still, not a word of the fighting, but just the sheep on the hill, and how you should get the crops in ere the year gets stormier, and the Boche have got his body, and I was his officer. You were only David's father, but I had 50 sons when we went up in the evening under the arch of the guns, and we came back at twilight. O God, I heard them call to me for help and pity that could not help at all. Oh, never will I forget you, my men that trusted me, more my sons than your father's, for they could only see the little helpless babies and the young men in their pride. They could not see you dying and hold you while you died. Happy and young and gallant, they saw their firstborn go, but not the strong limbs broken, and the beautiful men brought low. The piteous, writhing bodies, they screamed, "Don't leave me, sir," for they were only your fathers, but I was your officer.
The article was based around two stories in one battalion in the period leading up to the Somme battle, where they were conducting trench raids in the area, generally between Thiepval and La Boisselle.
Yep.
The fate of some of the individuals involved in those raids, the fate of some of those raiders, and then what happened to their body. And as the title of the article betrays, in both cases that I chose to write about, those that were killed on the raid, bodies were repatriated by the Germans. So, or not repatriated, that's definitely the wrong phrase, but brought back from the German front lines to burial grounds behind their lines in the two cases I covered, in Martinpuy and in Miramont.
So at this stage, those places are well behind. This is before the 1st of July. This is the build-up to the Somme, where our guys are going over on raids to try and find out how strong the Germans are, which units are there, you know, the situation of their trenches and dugouts. And they've done that. They've lost men. And then the Germans have taken them to places that people will be familiar with, like Martinpuich, but later on in the Battle of the Somme, because at this stage, they are part of the German. Those places are almost the second line of German defences, aren't they? They're well behind the line.
Yeah, exactly. They're well behind the line, sort of rear areas, places that German troops are transiting through on their way up to the front line, yeah. And then also supplying their front line from. So working parties are either going up from those places into the German front line to bring food, water, ammunition, and all the things that needed to sustain an army in the trench system. And then again, doing that in reverse. So yes. Going back when they're going out of the line, back towards perhaps Bapaume, or maybe even as far back as Cambrai and the villages surrounding those towns to rest. So yeah, very much behind the German lines, very much part of sort of their infrastructure, a mirrored infrastructure on their side of the line. But the one that I'm more familiar with, you're probably more familiar with, and I imagine your listeners are, the one behind our line. So, you know, thinking of places like Ocean Villas and Albert and all these places that served to service our front line and service the troops in the front line.
They become transport hubs almost, don't they? For
certainly. Yeah, and, I mean, people. You see that reflected, don't you, all over the Western Front, places named Transport Farm and this sort of thing.
Yep.
Again, you see that reflected. So the two raids I covered, the first one were, both of them, I should say, are by the 1st Battalion of Dorsetshire Regiment, which by this time was serving in the 32nd Division. They were a battalion that had gone out in 1914 with the 5th Division. But yeah, with the arrival of the Kitchener's armies on the Western Front, and as you know, they had swapped brigades and battalions around in order to spread the love, as it were, share the experience. They were then serving with the 32nd Division. So the first one I did was a raid down at opposite La Boisselle. So they'd done a lot of time in the line opposite the Wysap. And also the Glory Hole, places that you and I imagine a good number of your listeners.
Now, this is astride the main D929 Albert Road, where the Northumberland Fusiliers Memorial is now, around about there, isn't it?
Yeah, that's where the glory hole is. Yeah, exactly. And you can see the remains of the craters there on the right hand or the southern aspect of that road.
Yeah.
But this raid was conducted
on
to
the other
left
side.
Or on the northern side of the road in the direction of the YSAP. It was a set piece raid to be conducted by 80 men, split into two parties under two officers, one of them being called Blakeway. I believe, yeah, bloody hell, Blakeway he was called. Yep. And their task, like you said, was to get across no man's land, get into the German front line, establish which units are holding their front line, establish what their dispositions are, where the machine guns are, and then also talking to raids more widely, instill an offensive spirit in the battalion, you know, men that are spending lots of time in static positions, keep them motivated, keep them aggressive,
yep.
Get at the Germans and get forward. And as you've already said, you establish what their dispositions are.
We can listen now to the thoughts of a couple of soldiers that are involved with these trench raids, and they've got opposite views as to how necessary they were. The first one comes from an officer called Charles Wilson.
No, I think trench raids were necessary. I think they're necessary to get identifications and to find out where, you know, what troops were in the line and the opposite. Oh, they're absolutely necessary. But when you wanted identifications, then it had to be a proper raid with a barrage to cut the wire and so forth. But I'm sure they were quite necessary. And very important that one important part of the training of the men was to be accustomed to getting out into no man's land, to feel that they must be safe in a trench. Once they'd been out and had one or two experiences, they forgot all that.
But then when we listen to this interview given to the Imperial War Museum by Charles Quinnell of the Royal Fusiliers, we get a very different perspective.
We knew it was a waste of time. It was a waste of time. We just hated. But as time went on, to get the information, there was some general about 30 miles behind the line, wanted to know who was on the opposite side. And he would send up a message, raid so-and-so and get prisoners, just like that, you know. He ought to have had the job himself. Oh, God, men just hated it. They didn't mind going over the top, you know, with a fair chance. But by putting this box barrage down, you were sending an open postcard to the Germans to say, we're going to raid that bit there. In consequence was the Germans used to absolutely pour they used to throw everything barring the kitchen stove at you. Open fire with trench mortars, min and werpers, light guns, heavy guns, the lot.
He talks about some of the difficulties and challenges there that face a raiding party. If we go back to the interview with Neil Russell, he'll talk about that. He'll talk about those difficulties that cause the first trench raid and possibly even the second one to be a complete disaster.
So it's a real set-piece raid that was well-planned, directed from divisional level for them to do it. It wasn't the brainchild of the colonel or anything like that. So they spent a period of time behind the lines training in one of those villages we've just sort of spoken about. In this case, it was a place called Millencourt, where, again, they sort of dug knee-height trenches as a sort of a direct replica of the German line, which they were hoping to attack, where they were able to rehearse their assault.
And here we can listen to another veteran of the war describing a raid that he took part in, or the preparation for a raid that he took part in 1918.
Well, if they were going to make a raid, they'd have to prepare for it, you see. They'd have to go out and be trained for it. They'd know exactly what they've got to do. The people who were going to make this raid would go out to a training area where the whole trench system would be taped out, and they would know exactly what they got to do, where they got to go, and where everything was. Well, some people, before the raid would take place, would go out and cut wire so they could get through. And some people might go out to lay a telephone so that the chap on the raid could telephone back. That sort of thing. They used to have listening posts too. Out from the front line, about 20 or 30 yards, would be a little trench with a chap in there, and he would listen. He could hear in the dark, you know, and that sort of thing, you know.
So let's go back to the interview with Neil and follow exactly what happened to the 1st Dorsets as they prepared for their trench raid opposite the Wysap, the village of Le Boissel.
So they marched up on the day of the 25th of March, getting into trenches and 0 hours to be timed for 12:30 midnight. So half an hour into the new day, 26th of March. Mm. With this battalion, with this raid, we're sort of blessed, really, because there's two very good sources that exist, both of which I'm sure you'll be familiar with. The first one's a memoir by a guy called Charles Dewey, who wrote a book called The Weary Road. He was an officer in that battalion.
Yeah.
And then there is the edited letters of a sergeant major serving with the battalion called Ernest Shepherd.
Yeah.
I said edited letters, I meant edited diary entries.
Yes.
And both of them wrote about their view of the raid. Neither of them were part of the raiding force, but both of them were in the frontline trench, spoke to blokes in the raiding party before they went over at 12:30, and sort of sensed an atmosphere. And that atmosphere was that the Germans knew what was coming.
They knew it was coming.
Yes.
So even a trench road, let alone a battle, they even knew a trench raid was coming.
Exactly. They did on this occasion, something which you can actually link directly to the Battle of the Somme, and I'll come on as in the day of the Somme, which I will come to in a moment. So the atmosphere in the trench was pretty foreboding because the Germans were raking the parapet with machine gun fire almost on the minute and every minute. And they had spent the previous day registering fire on no man's land between our line and theirs, across the ground which the raiding party was going to traverse. And I think it's Charles Dewey who says in his memoir that he remembers seeing the colonel, although he was a major acting up as colonel, shoot, he was called. He remembers seeing him coming down the trench just before 0 hour with a very stern look on his face and very apprehensive about what was to happen imminently. Anyway, 12:29, so a minute before 0 hour, there's a mine explosion. A mine is detonated. As you know, that area is synonymous with mines. So a great deal of mine warfare, both when the French held it and then when the British sort of took over the line there. So a mine is detonated and the raiding party, under two officers in two groups, go out and attempt to attack the German lines simultaneously from two different directions. And it was Ernest Shepherd who said, he basically says in his diary that it was uncanny how quickly the Germans brought to bear their full arsenal of weaponry. So almost as the guys were going over the parapet, not only was it rifle fire from the sentries, but there was machine gun fire, firing, trench mortars, and indeed artillery all over this ground where the guys have got to traverse. So they begin making their way forward. Casualties are being incurred almost immediately as the battalion goes forward. And then as the raiding party rather goes forward, and then getting up into the German line in the area of the Wysap, they find the wires being cut. There's no wire obstructing them actually getting over the parapet, but the Germans, in anticipation of this raid, have dug their front line trench out. So rather than being a normal depth of a trench, it's much, much deeper.
And that protects them.
So it's to trap them, actually. So in the bottom,
attackers.
Exactly. In the bottom of the trench, there was concertina wire, circular-shaped concertina wire, wrapped in the bottom of the trench. So when the Dorset boys jumped, or the Dorset soldiers jumped into the German trench, first they had much further to fall, and then they were jumping down into barbed wire, which entrapped them, entangled them in those positions.
And there's no Germans in those trenches, of course, are there? The Germans are not there. They've pulled back.
Yeah, you're quite right, Terry. The Germans have evacuated back to their second line, but again, they're in waiting, they're expecting this trench raid. And then immediately on the Dorset's arrival, and you can imagine you're at the bottom of this trench, you're entangled in the barbed wire that the Germans have put there. The Germans start pressing on both sides with bombing parties, and they start bombing down their own frontline trench, concentrically trapping the Dorset's in the middle. Yeah, exactly. Not only that, but they're firing their own artillery and their own trench mortars onto their own front line. And very quickly, it's recognised that there's no fruit to be gained from this raid, and we should.
And there's only 80 of them, two parties of 40, you said.
Two parties of 40, yes.
Yeah.
Very quickly, the order about 12:35, so 5 minutes after zero, is given to get back. And in order to act as a beacon to the retiring raiding parties in our front line, they're sounding a Strombos horn just to aid those disorientated lads back to
their
own. But again, in anticipation of it, the Germans are firing machine guns now on fixed lines across the Dorset's line of retreat. So many, many more casualties are sustained in that retirement.
Mm.
Charles Dewey recounts in his book, The Night Parting, the mood is, of course, very somber with the casualties that have just been sustained in that operation, but not being able to see what had happened effectively. And then he describes, it's a great little passage in his book, the sun coming up, being able to see the village and lots of Dorsets, including Lieutenant Blakeway, hanging on the wire. He says he observed his friend, his brother officer Blakeway, just as a speck on the German wire. Then like a bit of to and fro between the British and the Germans, exchanges by way of signs, so writing things, and using that method, the Germans deliver the message that Blakeway has died of his wounds. They sent out what they would have called like a clearance patrol, so effectively a patrol in front of their line to sweep up any of the wounded, brought him in, and he died of his wounds, and they informed the Dorsets of that. And they took him back to Martinpuy, where they buried him.
Yeah.
And other raiders, one of whom was Charles Dewey's orderly, his Batman as well. He was killed in the raid.
Yeah.
And they were taken back to Martinpuy and buried. And if you look on the CWGC website, in the concentration or the burial report,
yeah.
It says the bodies were buried in coffins. Really? So, a great deal of care was put into memory.
Care and respect.
Yeah, care and respect, exactly. So I imagine born out of that mutual respect of combatants in the front line, sharing the same conditions, being subjected to the same terrors of the artillery barrages and that sort of thing.
Mm.
There's actually a photo. I don't know if you've seen Ralph Whitehead's book. He wrote a book on the Germans on the Somme called The Other Side of the Wire.
Yes.
There's a photo in there of a burial at Martinpuy. Now, yeah. I can't say it's the burial of the Dorsets, but it's representative of what it would look like, because there is a coffin.
Yeah.
There is a coffin in front of the burial party. There's officers stood there. They're wearing very smart looking uniforms. They don't look like they've just come out of a hole in the ground. Mm. And the main guy looks like he's wearing an Australian slouch hat, like an Akubra. He's not. I think I've had the magnifying glass on it. I think he's actually wearing like some sort of like felt Bavarian Jaeger sort of sport. Like
hunting,
sort of. Anyway, that's by the by. So, yeah, that's the story of the first raid.
So what happened to them then, having been buried at Martinpuy? There is a Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemetery there now. Are they still there, or have they been concentrated?
They are there, but they were concentrated from the German cemetery that was in Martinpuy at the time of the war. And I think it's in that concentration port, actually, where you'll find the detail concerning the coffin.
Yes.
Coffins, rather.
They haven't moved them far, they haven't moved to one of the big cemeteries.
No, they haven't. They are in Martinpuy now.
Yeah, probably still in those coffins then, you'd hope.
Yes, yeah, that's right, yeah.
Yeah.
I think, in fact, there's an additional detail actually in that report. I think the Germans buried him as an unknown officer.
Right.
But when they exhumed it to concentrate it, to reinter it in the now CWGC cemetery, there was, I think it was on his breeches or perhaps on his tunic, his name, and identified and other members of the raiding party. So yeah, that's where they are now. Yeah,
well, that's my first stop next time I go to the Somme.
Oh, I'll put
the bag down. I'm off to Martinpuy, and I'm going to find Blakeway and his fellow men that died that
I'll
day.
I'll be sure to send you the other names, Terry, as well.
Yeah, they'll all be together, won't they?
Yeah, but that pleases me to hear that, because what you just said then is pretty much how I conclude my article by saying, hopefully just what, if one person goes to visit, as you're going to do, then that's great.
We'll get a photo. We must have a photo of Blakeway, surely, hopefully.
Yes, there is. Yeah, you'll find a photo online. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. We'll put that in front of his grave, take a photo and put that on social media.
I'll be really pleased to see that. Really, yeah. Very much.
So before we listen to the second story that Neil's got for us, let's listen to the words of Walter Spencer. And he talks about what it was like to try and get from one of those trench raids a German prisoner. This is what he said.
Well, you try and get down to a part of the enemy trench where you thought it was least manned, you see, and you'd grab a prisoner if you could, and of course he'd give a gawk, and that's when the fun started, because he shouted that they'd manned the trench, you see, and anything that was moving they would put on. But invariably, if you get a rope to come, directly you got him out of the trench, he'd come with you, all right? And he'd get him back to the line. But it was a very hazardous job. We lost a lot of men on patrols, of course.
Right. That was the first one then. And there's another one.
Yeah, and then there was a second raid. So the Germans had raided the Dorsets opposite Tietvau in Tietvau Wood on about the 6th or the 7th of May, something like that. So a couple of months after the raid we've just spoke about.
Yeah.
And they inflicted a massive number of casualties, something like 33 or perhaps even 40 killed and wounded. And more embarrassingly for the Dorsets, and that's not me saying that, that's how they felt. They captured about 25 guys, I think 23 guys, including a sergeant. And there's some very good photos of the German divisional commander for that sector, Fabeck, speaking to them at his divisional headquarters behind the line. Anyway, the so what from that raid is the Dorsets were, it really got their hackles up. They felt sort of, I think the word is embarrassed. They sort of felt embarrassed by it and looked to exact some revenge on the Germans.
Get their own back.
Series of raids. Yeah, so they're going out to no man's land a lot, and a guy called Algeo and Mansell Pleydell, they are leading a lot of raids out into no man's land. Mansell Pleydell, he was the intelligence officer of the battalion, an actual Dorsetshire boy, son of a vicar in Dorsetshire. He was a pretty intrepid bloke. He had got into the German lines a number of times, sometimes on his own, and at one point he had brought back some plates from the German line. Now, it doesn't the original source doesn't say whether it means cutlery plates or whether they mean sniper plates. I should imagine it means like a steel sniper plate, but
that sounds better anyway, doesn't it? Yeah, more exciting.
Although I can imagine, and then one morning, I think it was the morning of the 17th of May, in another one of these raids and patrols of no man's land, in an effort to instill confidence in the battalions, whose confidence at that point was pretty shaken, and it was felt in that sector the Germans had the ascendancy. They had a lot of recent successful raids, the 99th Reserve Regiment raiding out of Tietvau. So Blakeway and Algeo's he was a regular soldier, captain, a company commander, someone who had been with the battalion for a long time. He was involved in their famous defence of Hill 60, for example, in May 1915, and someone that features a lot in Ernest Shepherd's diary and a little bit in Charles Dewey book as well. They went out, Mansell Pleydell leading and Algeo following him, and they went out through the Hammerhead Sap, which, if you've seeing the trench maps for up around that area, sort of goes in the direction of the Chateau Gardens and where Diamond Copse was. And then on their arrival at Diamond Copse, a commotion broke out. Algeo was heard to be shouting, put it down, lay your weapons down. And then there was a sound of musketry heard from our trenches. And the last that was seen of them was Mansell played down in front, gesturing to Algeo to come forward, like saying, come here sort of thing. That was the last that they were observed. It then all went quiet and nothing was heard from them for another hour. The pioneer sergeant, a friend to Algeo, a pre-war friend, a guy called Goodwillie, Sergeant Goodwillie, and he's the picture of old Billy. He's got a big old moustache, much better than mine. really looks like the pre-war regular. Looks not dissimilar to old Bill. He volunteered to go out with Sergeant Rogers and look for them. So they go out and they meet almost exactly the same fate, really. Those that stayed behind in the trench hear a commotion breaking out. Hear some musketry, and then it's silence. A further hour passes, and Rogers comes in and says that Goodwillie was too anxious to get forward. He moved too quickly. He was observed by the Germans and was shot. And was shot and killed. And again, sort of linking it to the previous trench raid, all three of those guys were taken from the German positions there in Tietvau, down into the Ancre Valley, back to Miremont, which, as you said, was well behind the German lines at that point, and is buried in the communal cemetery there. You'll find them, you'll find all three of them buried down there. Great little sort of pilgrimage, great little touch point to go to behind the German line, something I've done a couple of times.
Now, for people that don't know, Miremont is on the other side of where the Canadians attacked the Regina Trench area, and which became the objective for the February 1917 Boom Ravine attack, wasn't it?
That's right.
That's the story for that one. Blimey.
Yes, and it's again one of those places because you've got the literature, you know, you've got both of these people featuring in Charles Dewey's Weary Road Book and in Shepherd's Diary. So it's a great one to
Yeah.
you can really
And those three that are buried there, are there photos of any or all of those, you know?
There is photos of all three of them.
Oh,
Yes.
great. So we can line those up. And are they all buried together, do you know, in that?
Yes, they are. Yeah.
Right,
Yes.
that'd be a good experience to go there, isn't it? You need reasons to go to these cemeteries, don't you, I think? And going to see individuals, it really brings it alive, doesn't it? It brings the headstone alive.
We did, and the only postscript to that raid, I can do it in one sentence, is it was felt that there was a degree of underhandness from the Germans, despite what they actually did. The truth is, they took these bodies away and buried them respectfully, but it was felt that these guys could have been murdered. And that resulted in the address before the battalion went over on the first day of the Somme from Major Shute. He addressed the battalion at Black Horse Bridge and he implored the battalion to get their revenge for Algeo, Mansell, Pleydell, and Goodwillie. And said he finished his address by saying, "No prisoners for the Dorsets."
Right. So that, I suppose
Fortunately,
that's another story, isn't it? But the first Dorsets, am I right in thinking that there's a memorial at the bottom of the hill by the Connaught Cemetery there, and their story was a disaster, wasn't it, coming out of Auchtwil Wood?
yeah, that's right. By Lonsdale Cemetery, coming out of Auchtwil Wood, exactly, or like up towards Leipzig Salient, they were to go up beyond the Leipzig Salient in the direction of Mouquet Farm, but they never made it that far, of
Oh.
course. That's, you know, so many battalions.
It's not just the British, of course, that carried out trench raids. The Germans were doing the same to us, and we're going to look at a couple of those stories. Now, this first one, we can listen to a man called Frank Holding, who was serving with the Lancashire Fusiliers on the Somme once again, just before the Great Push. This was April, the end of April 1916, when his trenches were raided by the Germans. And he tells the story of a mate of his, Thomas Wilson. And Thomas Wilson has a connection with my own World War I story, which I'll explain once Frank has told us what happened on that terrible day.
The Germans came over and raided us. And we had a number of casualties with five officers killed. Five officers were killed when the Germans got through into our, and they did a hell of a lot of damage. I went to see, there was a small hospital at Boozing Court, and I'd been told that a lad named Tom Wilson, who was lived opposite me in Station Road, was in this small village hospital in Boozing Court. I went round to see him, and I was told I got permission to go, and unfortunately, he died 2 days later, and I went to see him buried. And I made a sketch of where his body was, sent it to his mother. That was Tom Wilson.
Well, it's another one of those Great War, First World War coincidences, because as soon as he mentioned Boussincourt, my ears pricked up, because it's in Boussincourt that my own great uncle is buried. He died a few months after Tom in August of 1916, and he's buried at Boussincourt. So I thought, well, there's two cemeteries there. There's one in the village, which was a field ambulance, and there's another one on the ridge before you get to the village if you come from the main battlefield area. So I searched the Commonwealth War Graves Commission records, and lo and behold, not only is Tom buried in the same cemetery as my great uncle, he's buried just two rows away. He was from Manchester. He lived in 5 Station Road, Patricroft in Manchester, and his parents were called Arthur and Martha Wilson. And they chose the family inscription for his headstone, which simply said, "He died for freedom and honour." So when I return to the Somme in spring, of course, I'll go and pay my respects to my great uncle Henry, but I'll then look out for Tom, I'll go and find his grave, and I'll think about how he died in that awful trench raid in April of 1916, and I'll think of his mate Frank, who, as he said, sketched the grave and sent that back to Tom's mum, Martha. Now, for this next story, I'm very grateful to Jonathan Porter. He's an author of two volumes of a book which, if you're interested in the Somme, you really must get. It's a reference book called 0 Hour Z Day. I say he's produced two volumes of these and provides so much detailed information, photos, maps, accounts of what happened on the 1st of July. But he's also, a few weeks ago, put on Facebook an account of a German raid that was carried out on trenches that were being held by a battalion that we feature a lot in this podcast, the 6th Battalion of the Northamptons, my hometown. And it was another one of those days that was not going to be recorded in any detail in the history of the Northamptonshire 6th Battalion, a battalion that later on in the Battle of the Somme was to go on to achieve such great things that we covered in the podcast before, but not on this day, because probably embarrassment and shame are the words that we can use to describe what happened to the Northamptons on that cold winter's night between Christmas and New Year of 1915. I have in front of me an unpublished history of what's called the Glorious Six, the history of the 6th Service Battalion of the North Ants, typed up in an exercise book. As I say, this book has never been published. But on page 9, it tells us that on the 27th of December 1915, the rain had been falling for some days and it continued. In the afternoon, our artillery used a fortnight's supply of ammunition by firing some 800 shells into the German trenches in and around Fricourt. 2 days later, on the 29th, the Germans retaliated with 2,000 shells between 3:30 and 5:30 p.m. and some of these were gas shells. At the end of the bombardment, the enemy entered our trenches west of the cemetery. When they say the cemetery, they mean the civilian cemetery at this stage. There wasn't a war cemetery there in Fricourt in 1915. It surprised 20 of the 6th, who were taken prisoner and escorted to the enemy lines. And that's all it says. But in his book, 0 Hour, Jonathan has recounted from a German perspective exactly what happened in that raid. And it was to involve the Reserve Infantry Regiment 110. And the German account says that they'd tried before unsuccessfully to capture a British soldier, so they had orders to carry out a raid with the aim of rectifying this by the close of the year. And being the 29th of December, they'd only got 2 days before. Three officers and 45 German men were chosen from the unit, and they were split into three equal assault parties. And the position of the British line runs along the Albert-Peronne-Fricourt-Bray crossroads. That was selected as the target. There was a house and outbuildings, and the British first trench ran through its back garden. The German raiding party was grouped together at Bazentin, which was well behind the lines, and like the British had been doing, they built a replica of the target and they carried out rehearsals. It says that they prepared a number of asphyxiating gas shells that were to be utilised prior to 0 hour, and that would make it the first time that this type of gas would be used in such a scale for an attack or a raid on the Somme sector. And of course the Germans had to practice their assault using newly issued gas masks. This is very early in the formation of gas as a weapon, really. On the 27th of December, a reconnaissance patrol under Lieutenant Weiss crossed No Man's Land with the intentions of confirming the target was occupied. And as the patrol edged closer to the British wire, an alert sentry spotted the German. A grenade fight broke out, during which Weiss and four of his men were wounded. And as they withdrew, it was noticed that one of their party was missing. And to a man, the able-bodied patrollers volunteered to search for their lost comrade, successfully bringing him back in. But Weiss's injuries meant that he wasn't going to be able to participate in the main raid, which was set, as we know, for the late afternoon 2 days later. And that morning, individual parties moved up to the front and occupied the dugouts along the southern edge of Fricourt. And in the regimental history, another German officer describes the bombardment. He says the smouldering fire trails of the shells looked like a wild army of shooting stars, and over there the great work of destruction began. Segment after segment of the objective was covered with every calibre of shell. Huge fountains of earth sprayed up and fell back with a thump, intermingled with large beams that whirled through the air. And then the actual raid began. Raiders darted forward, covering by supporting fire to within 50 metres of the British parapet. Here they waited so close to their own barrage they could feel the blast of each detonation and see mortar bombs fall out of the night sky. The officer in charge was a man called Vulpius. He waited, watching his watch as the fingers crept down to 6 p.m. and then he gave the order. "Up at the double," he said. As the raiders scrambled to their feet, a heavy mortar fired in the final seconds fell on a target position. Vulpius shouted to take cover, but the detonation caught them in the open. Shell splinters hissed by and it wounded one man. Within seconds, they were back on their feet, picking routes through the shattered British wire. The smell of gas still lingered, so the order to don masks was given. As they entered the target position, it appeared gas was dissipating, and a counter-order was given to unmask. Supporting fire, artillery, mortars and machine guns lifted to the rear and flanks, and with a small party to guard their escape route, the main assault section made for what remained of the buildings, aided by lights from flares and explosions. Simultaneously, another officer's assault group entered the British trench to the north, close to the crossroads, and once beside the building, Vulpius discovered an entrance leading to a cellar. Fearing that his colleague's party may have descended into the dugout, he shouted the password down the stairs. Upon hearing British voices, he tossed a grenade into the dark, and within seconds a loud detonation reverberated and smoke bellowed from the entrance, followed by shouts of panicking men. Needing to take live prisoners, Vulpius shouted in his best English, "Discard your weapons! Come up immediately!" And after no response, he shouted, "Are you wounded?" To which a voice replied, "Yes, yes," but still no one appeared. After some reassurance that they'd be treated well, the occupants still declined to show themselves. With the raid withdrawal signal initiated, Vulpius made one final attempt to obtain a surrender. "Either you come up or you get a second grenade." This time it worked. A long line of men, with their hands out to their front, faces showing fear of the unknown, ascended the steps. All were soldiers of No. 4 Platoon, A Company, 6 Northants. In the dugout cellar, one man and three other Northamptons evaded capture by hiding in a corner. In the confusion, a further corporal and two lance corporals escaped. Vulpius ordered the prisoners, 13 in all, to follow his men, with warning they would be shot if they tried to escape. Two soldiers carried the seriously wounded Private Jess Chamberlain, who had shrapnel wounds to his stomach. He would die the following morning in captivity. Back in the German lines, news spread that the other party had also taken 7 Northamptons, bringing the total bag to 20. That corresponds with the Northamptons' history. The raid was a complete success for the Reserve Infantry Regiment 110, with only one casualty, the soldier that was wounded by friendly mortar fire. For their leadership on the raid, the two officers were decorated with the Iron Cross First Class, and as was Weiss for the reconnaissance. Others received the Iron Cross Second Class, and all received a leave pass to visit home. But of course, on the other side of the wire, it was a complete and utter disaster for those men from my county town. A subsequent inquiry found that several factors which had assisted the raiders entering their position. Their platoon officer wasn't present, having been delayed on his return from leave. The sergeant had gone on leave. Another sergeant had disappeared to HQ and on his return was gassed, and that left only a corporal in charge. One of the sentries was knocked off his post and another pair appeared at the cellar declaring they could not take the bombardment any longer, was the quote. The pair were not replaced. These failures meant the Germans could simply walk in unchallenged. Many lessons were learned amongst claims of cowardice from the divisional commander. And this incident brought about alterations to procedures, and eventually that meant that there was improved defence. Now, I don't know what happened that night. Obviously, mistakes were made. But I know from what the Northamptons achieved a few months later in the taking of Tiepwal and the taking of Trones Wood, believe me, these guys weren't cowards. They were overcome by a highly skilled, trained, motivated and brilliantly led German unit. None of those 20 men or the few that died, including Chamberlain, can be blamed for what happened, can they? As for that man, Chamberlain, his name was Private 10696 Jesse Chamberlain, and he lived in Albert Street here in Northampton. And although he's buried in the AIF burial ground at Fleur, he has a special memorial because he's one of those headstones that was later destroyed in the battles on the Somme. But we know from his records, from what the Germans told us, that he died as a prisoner of war and was buried there at Fleur. And when I go back to the Somme, I'll also visit this cemetery and I'll find that headstone and I'll pay my respects to Jesse. Two other men from the Northamptonshires, the 6th Battalion, the same company, died that night. Sergeant George Gough was from Northampton. Before he joined the army, him and his wife Ada, they ran the East End Tavern in Melbourne Street in Northampton. And the other one that died was a man called Albert Butler. And both Butler and Gough are buried next to each other in the Milt Military Cemetery, which is just behind the lines and at this stage was the location of a casualty clearing station. So it's possible that they died of wounds, maybe after that German officer threw a hand grenade into the dugout where those Northampton lads were sheltering. Jonathan has provided me with a full list of the 20 men that were taken prisoner that night. Most of them are from the county of Northamptonshire, one or two that are not. One man, Wilfred Underwood, he was from Rochdale. I don't know how he came to be serving in the North Ants. One of the men I've tracked down, Private 13911, Fred Trasler, he returned to Northampton and lived in the St James area of the town. In 1923, he got married and he lived until 1984 when he died at the age of 88. I wonder whether throughout his long life, if he ever managed to forget the horrors of what he experienced that night. The fear of knowing that an officer, a German officer, the enemy, was standing there with a hand grenade, waiting to end your life, not knowing what was ahead of you as you were taken prisoner of war. I wonder what he experienced in those prisoner of war camps. And I wonder how he dealt with civilian life when he came back to Northampton after the war. But he had a long time to remember that, as he lived, as I said, until the 1980s. I've got one more account that I want to read for you today. And it comes from a man called Lance Corporal W. Stevens, who was serving with the King's Own Loyal North Lancashires. And it was published in the War Illustrated magazine in October of 1916. And it really brings home the brutality of the hand-to-hand fighting that occurred when either side got into each other's trenches on a raid. And as I said at the beginning of this podcast, it scares me more than anything. I cannot imagine being in the boots of Lance Corporal Stevens. Just listen to what he has to say. Try and imagine what he went through and try and imagine what those poor Germans went through when they were attacked by the British on that dark night in 1916. At last, the word came and we went over the parapet, not with a yell as the lads do when charging, but silently. I remember passing a gas cylinder which was leaking and I got a full whiff of the stuff for a start. That nearly floored me, but I stuck it and bent double. I ran on till the effects had passed off. The next thing that I came across was some barbed wire that had once belonged to the German third line trench, and this nearly tripped me up. As I had half a hundredweight of bombs slung around me, and as many of the pins had shaken out, it would have made a mess of me had I fallen, although I didn't realise this at the time. Finally, we came to what had once been a road, but now it was nothing but a series of shell craters, half full of water, but excellent cover for all that. The one I got to had seven dead Germans still in it, but we quickly dumped these out of the way and took their places up to the waist in mud and rainwater. Then we waited for the bombardment that was nearly due. I looked at my watch and it said 10 minutes to 10. I knew that at 10 sharp our guns would start, but I never knew 10 minutes to take up so long passing before. Then it came suddenly. It was all heavy stuff and we crouched low. We were also afraid of shells blowing back, which means that instead of the enemy getting the benefit, you get the shrapnel and high explosives in your faces. Just then the guns lifted and we stood by. "Get ahead, wire cutters," was the order, "and see if everything's clear." They took the telephone wire with them, and soon word came back that the enemy was smashed out of existence. We passed it on to the gunners, and they gave us 5 more minutes to wait. Boom! The guns were blazing away like steam. 5 minutes up, over you go, with our heads well tucked in, right on the heels of the shells. As the guns lifted, we went forward, scrambling and racing in the darkness. I reached the German trench before I knew it. I slithered down, losing my tin hat in the slide. I found a dugout quite close, and such a dugout too. I yelled, "Come out, you beggars, or I'll smoke you out." 2 Württembergers climbed out, looking as scared as possible. "2 here, sir," I yelled to our officer, whose voice I could hear to our left. He came up at the run, brandishing a service revolver in one hand and an electric torch in the other. "Off they go," he ordered. "Send a couple of hands to take them back to the prisoner conducting party." They went, but they really didn't need any guard. They seemed only too glad to be out of the mess with their skins whole, and the way they ran in front, shifting dead bodies and stray pieces of wire from the path, was pitiful. "Better make sure there's no one else down there," was the order, and again I yelled. I got no answer, and 2-4 minutes afterwards, to allow anybody to change his mind if need be, I made them a present of a couple of the best. Hand grenades, he means. Then I passed on to the next dugout, and the next, and gave them a similar dose. And all the time I seemed to be doing nothing but keeping myself from slipping down in the mud and muck. I disposed of about 30 bombs when one of my pals came running round a corner. The whole of the left side of his face was bleeding horribly. "Bill, old man," he said, "I'm bleeding to death. You might do me a good turn and wallop that crowd of Germans just around the corner. There's about 100 of them holding a dugout with bombs, and they've played hell with my platoon." He hardly finished speaking when another chap I knew came staggering round the corner. He was blind and was feeling his way along the parados to his friends. I sent a couple more lads with them to the prisoner conducting party to be patched up, and then, with the rest of the section, went round the traverse at the rush. Just at the corner, one chap let out a yell. "I'm blown to bits," he said. He'd only got a smack under the belt with a piece of spent grenade, and later I saw him fighting like the Dickens. We'd no time to attend the casualties now. The Germans had got wind of our coming and were lobbing bombs and grenades over the twist of the traverse, and random shooting though it was, they made excellent practice amongst us. But instead of stopping us, these bombs only spurred us on. We did let out one yell, and that must have been given the Huns a fright, for they ceased fire for a minute. The next, we were slap on top of them, and we slung bombs right and left into them. They fought hard and gave us as good as we sent, until finally they ran a bit short of ammo and started to run down the mouth of the dugout. Soon there rose into the air 3 rockets, one after the other, and they burst with a cloud of red stars. Then some German lit a red flare, and with a final yell and a rush, we charged, bombing as we went. All my grenades had gone by this time, and I was armed with a trenching tool. I'd fitted the shaft this earlier, and now I used it as a battle axe, and I stopped fully 6 Germans from bolting down that rabbit hutch. At last, we'd got them all in. And there was only 5 of us left that weren't wounded. We stood and looked at each other for a second in the dim light caused by the star shells sent up by the Germans. We were in a pickle too, and no mistake. Faces as black as coal, hands and clothes smothered with mud and stains of German and British blood. Our pals and 6 bombs between us. Somewhere down the trench, we could hear the grenades still exploding, but we fancied they were some distance off. Fully 40 Germans were in that dugout, and they wouldn't come out at all. Suddenly, we saw the reason of the red rockets and flares. The German guns started strafing us like Dickens. They must have had the range of the trench to an inch, though they only dropped occasional shells into it. They contented themselves with making a curtain of fire just behind us, through which we could get no supports or supplies. "For the last time," I yelled into that dugout, "are you coming out in peace or pieces?" No reply, not a single head showing. "Right then," I said, "here goes." And I sent the last 6 grenades down that dugout, one after the other. Still, there was no rush for the entrance, and unless that dugout went right underground for at least 500 yards, there wasn't a man left to answer after the bombs had gone off. "Well, we'll get back, lads," said I, being in charge now, because we'd lost our officer somewhere. Pick up the dead and wounded as well as you can and make for the traverse. Lucky as we reached it, we found a party coming to look for us and they helped with our dead and wounded. We went back over the top and into that awful hell of fire, carrying our dead and wounded and driving 50 Germans, including three officers before us. Four men to a dead Tommy, two at least to a wounded man. Then I felt as if some mighty hand had hit me on the small of the back. I tumbled over hills and I lost my trenching tool. When I stopped rolling, I felt myself all over, particularly my head, and licked my fingers in the dark to see if they tasted of salt, which would have been blood. I seemed okay, but I couldn't move any farther afterwards, and it took four men to get me in. Then, back in the trench, they mustered us and we'd lost a number of hands with several wounded. But glory of glories, we'd cleared a German trench. And when we brought in every dead soldier and all the wounded ones, including myself, I was stunned by shell shock. Shell shock only after that passage. It's strange what it takes to kill a chap nowadays. He writes that with such spirit, doesn't he? Almost with a sense of humour with that final sentence. But as with all the accounts that we've read this week, it wasn't a joke, it wasn't funny. This was the worst kind of mankind, throwing hand grenades into dugouts, tearing to pieces those poor human beings that are down there. It's no one's fault. This is the not-so-glory of war. This is personal. This is hand-to-hand fighting. It's not like firing guns from several miles behind the lines onto an enemy that you cannot see and will never know. These men came face to face with one another. Remember, he said he used his trenching tool as a battle axe and stopped half a dozen Germans from going into a dugout. So he must have hit them over the head. The head, the human head, that skull is very brittle. It's quite soft, really. You can only imagine the wounds that those men got. Only imagine the effect that it had on those that came back. I'm so thankful, for one, that that wasn't me, and all I've got to do is sit here and try and tell their story in some way. I hope I've done that this week, and I'm very grateful, of course, to Neil Russell for telling the stories of those two failed raids from the Somme battlefield in 1916. Neil will be coming back on the podcast later on in the year to talk about the Hindenburg Line and the Battle of Cambrai. But in the meantime, we remember all of those soldiers from both sides of the wire that died in those trench raids by the playing of The Last Post.